From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Behind the invincible Men in Black is a neurotic film director named Barry Sonnenfeld. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Sonnenfeld. He made both Men in Black films, as well as The Addams Family, Get Shorty, and Big Trouble. The contested phrase, under God, has drawn new attention to the Pledge of Allegiance. A lot of kids recite the pledge without even comprehending what many of the words mean. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has some thoughts on the obscure language of the pledge. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. U.S. business leaders say they hope President Bush's address on Wall Street today can restore investor confidence in the corporate sector after a wave of accounting scandals. The president called for harsher punishments for executives who mislead investors. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
The president said he wants to end the days of cooking the books and shading the truth and create a new era of corporate integrity. Goldman Sachs CEO and chairman Henry Paulson said that with his remarks, the president had gotten things just right.
He is CEO of our country. He needs to set the tone, and I think he did a great job of setting the tone this morning.
The president said he would set up a task force to coordinate the work of government agencies that investigate and prosecute corporate malfeasance. He also wants to increase funding for the Securities and Exchange Commission, though his proposed increases are considerably smaller than those already proposed in Congress. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
The Senate has voted to override a veto from the state of Nevada and allow the storage of more than 70,000 acres of nuclear waste under the Nevada desert. The vote clears the way for the Energy Department to develop a storage site at Yucca Mountain, about 90 miles northwest of Las Vegas. The $58 billion project is intended to contain radioactive waste that's now stored at nuclear power plants and other sites in 39 states. Critics say the site hasn't been proven safe enough to contain the waste, which must be stored for thousands of years. They say there's also a greater hazard of transporting the waste from its current locations to the Yucca Mountain site. A new study by the insurance industry shows that 3 out of 4 new, smaller-sized sport utility vehicles have earned the highest rating for safety in front-end collisions. Quinn Kleinfelter reports from member station WDET.
The Insurance Institute of America tested the SUVs by crashing their driver's side front end into a barrier at a speed of 40 miles per hour. The Institute says their results show that the 2002 Honda CR-V, the 2003 Subaru Forester, and the 2002 Saturn View earned the best ratings possible for limiting potential injuries to passengers. The 2002 Land Rover Freelander earned an acceptable rating. Insurance analysts say the positive results from this latest study indicate that automakers are making gains in efforts to improve the safety of the popular models. The Insurance Institute says newer, larger SUVs also appear to be performing better in crash tests. For NPR News, I'm Quinn Kleinfelter in Detroit.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 179 points, or nearly 2%, to close at 9,096 in heavy trading of more than 1.3 billion shares. The Nasdaq Composite Index lost 24 points, or 1.7%, to close at 1381. This is NPR News. United Airlines machinists have rejected a company proposal that they accept a 10% pay cut. The airline wanted pay concessions from all its workers as part of a package of measures to help it recover from $2 billion in losses after September 11th. United cut wages for its managers and other salaried staff and worked out a tentative plan for a 10% pay cut from pilots. The 35,000 union machinists agreed to defer a nearly $500 million in retroactive pay, but refused the pay cut. United wants nearly $2 billion in loan guarantees from the government to help it stay in business. Fair weather is helping fire crews move aggressively against one of Colorado's most persistent wildfires. Eric Whitney reports from member station KSUT.
Predicted high winds failed to materialize today near the western Colorado city of Glenwood Springs, allowing progress against a fire that's been burning there for 2.5 weeks. Officials are reporting success with a controlled burn on the edge of that 8,000-acre blaze that should rob it of fuel and prevent its further spread. In southwestern Colorado, crews are close to containing the huge fire that's been burning near the town of Durango since June 9th. It's now 87% contained and should be fully surrounded by Thursday. But that fire and others around Colorado have left massive amounts of ash and debris on steep mountain slopes that's likely to cascade down as mud as summer rains continue. Emergency officials are urging property owners near burned areas to buy flood insurance as soon as possible. For NPR News, I'm Eric Whitney in Durango, Colorado.
Flooding from the Texas Hill Country is moving downstream, bringing high water to farming communities between the hills and the Gulf Coast. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation for support of the NPR Endowment, helping to ensure NPR's financial future.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
At any given time, there are around 1,500 aliens on the planet, most of them right here in Manhattan. And most of them are decent enough. They're just trying to make a living.
Cab drivers.
Well, not as many as you'd think. Humans, for the most part, don't have a clue. They don't want one or need one either. They're happy. They think they have a good bead on things.
That's Tommy Lee Jones in a scene from the 1997 film Men in Black, the comedy about special agents who patrol the Earth looking for extraterrestrials disguised as people and animals. The new sequel just broke the box office record for a July 4th weekend opening. My guest Barry Sonnenfeld directed Men in Black and Men in Black 2. He also made The Addams Family, Addams Family Values, Get Shorty, and Big Trouble. In the first Men in Black, Tommy Lee Jones played the most cunning of all agents, Agent K, who has to train a new partner, Agent J, played by Will Smith. In the sequel, the roles are reversed. Tommy Lee Jones has gone into retirement and is working at a post office in Truro, Massachusetts. When he left the Men in Black, they erased all his memory of his work with the aliens. But now Will Smith has to bring him out of retirement and restore Jones's memory because Jones is the only person who has the clues that can help stop a diabolical alien plot against the Earth. Not only have Smith and Jones returned for the sequel, so has Frank the Pug, the alien talking dog who also sings.
And so you're back from outer space. I just walked in to find you here with that sad look upon your face. Should've changed that stupid lock. Should've made you leave your key. If I'd known for just 1 second, you'd be back to bother me. Go on now, go. Walk out the door.
Just Barry Sonnenfeld, welcome to Fresh Air. When you made the first Men in Black, did you know then that you'd likely be making a sequel?
No, when we were doing the first Men in Black, we're very lucky that we didn't know we were making a sequel, because if we did know we were making a sequel, the studio, which is Sony Pictures, never would have let us taken away Tommy Lee Jones's memory at the end of the first one and send him on his way back to Truro, Massachusetts, and would have said, that's not the way you end the movie that's going to have a sequel. So we were actually incredibly lucky that we didn't know we were going to be a fairly successful film.
Was it hard to get Tommy Lee Jones or Will Smith to agree to do the sequel?
Tommy Lee Jones and Will Smith just love these characters and very much wanted to come back and do a sequel. In fact, the sort of cool thing for me was to see Tommy see himself for the first time in Men in Black and see that he actually was funny. Tommy had no idea that he was a funny person or that he could get laughs as an actor. And I think it brought him such joy to be in a movie theater and see people laughing at what looks like a very effortless performance that Tommy very much wanted to come back. Will very much wanted to come back. They, you know, they are the coolest heroes.
Was it hard to get Frank the dog, the talking dog, to agree to make the sequel?
As you know, one of the big surprises of the sequel is that we have a talking dog named Frank the Pug, who's actually named Mushu. Mushu is a 7-year-old pug. He was in the first movie in a small role and comes back in a much bigger role in Men in Black 2 and gets a lot of the biggest laughs because he sings disco. Now, what I love about Frank is you can watch television and see 15 different commercials with talking dogs, from Taco Bell to, you know, I think Blockbuster has hamsters and rabbits that talk. But what I love about Frank is he's got really bad attitude. He's a womanizer. he sings bad disco. So I love that. And in fact, he's so good and was so well-trained that I have talked to his trainer. And if we do Men in Black 3, I have convinced her that if we get the script to Mushu early enough, I believe he can learn the lines and do his own lines instead of having us, animate his mouth using various computer techniques.
Well, one of the really funny aspects of Men in Black 1 and 2 is that it really, really plays on the feeling that many of us have, that the people around us are so odd they can't be Earthlings. Like, they must be from another planet. And, of course, in Men in Black, they really are from another planet. What did you like about that premise, that all the really peculiar people and animals around you and insects really are from another planet?
Well, you know, I grew up in New York City, and you walk around New York all day long, and, you know, there are people talking to themselves, and there are people that almost look like they're human, but not quite. And in fact, the first Men in Black, when I was given the script, took place in Lawrence, Kansas, Washington, D.C., Nevada, California. And when I read it, I said, look, the first thing I want to do if you want to hire me is I want to rewrite the script so that it all takes place in New York City, because my theory is that if there are aliens, they would be in New York, because most of them could get by without actually having to put on makeup or, you know, different outfits. They literally can, about half of the aliens can pass in New York without doing anything different. But more than if there are or aren't aliens in the world, there's a speech that Tommy Lee Jones gives to Will Smith to convince him to join Men in Black about halfway through the first Men in Black. And what Tommy says is, look, 2,000 years ago, everyone on Earth knew the Earth was the center of the universe. 500 years ago, everyone knew the Earth was flat. Think about what you'll know tomorrow.
Are any of the aliens in Men in Black variations on people, animals, or insects that you actually knew and suggested for the movie?
You know, I think aliens are more a state of mind than an actual physical reality. I do believe that there's all sorts of stuff that we don't know about, and I believe that as we're speaking, there's probably various dimensions in the room with us sort of, well, in my case, sort of spitting at me for no apparent reason except they don't like me. And I'm not being paranoid when I say this. I truly believe that. But I don't think that there's anyone that you or I sort of see on a daily basis, even though we make fun of certain actors and celebrities as being aliens. Like, for instance, I will say that Martha Stewart, who is in Men in Black 2, you know, is capable of making a Bush Noel that no one else could make. You know, the way it looks like a log and the way that she puts exactly the right candied flowers on it. And I mean, I remember once watching a Julia Child and Martha Stewart making exactly the same dish side by side, and Julia Child's dish looking extraordinarily bad, and Martha's looking unbelievably perfect. But I'm not saying that Martha Stewart is an alien. I'm just saying she's better than anyone else at what she does.
Barry Sonnenfeld is my guest, and he directed Men in Black and Men in Black 2. Both the Men in Blacks are filled with low, high-tech gizmos. You know, high-tech gizmos, but the real cheapo versions of it, like the Neuralizer, which makes you forget your real-life encounters with aliens and with the Men in Black. And when the Neuralizer is used, the agent, the Men in Black agent, makes up a new memory to replace the memory that they've erased. In fact, let's hear a scene from Men in Black 1 in which Tommy Lee Jones and Will Smith neuralize a woman whose husband has been killed by aliens.
All right, Beatrice, there was no alien. Flash of light you saw in the sky was not a UFO. Swamp gas from a weather balloon was trapped in a thermal pocket and refracted the light from Venus.
Well, wait a minute. So you just flash that thing, it erases her memory, and you just make up a new one?
A standard issue neuralizer.
And that weak-ass story is the best you can come up with.
All right. On a more personal note, Beatrice, Edgar ran off with an old girlfriend. You're gonna go stay with your mom a couple of nights, you're gonna get over it and decide you're better off.
Well, yeah, you know, because he never appreciated you anyway. In fact, you know what? You kicked him out. And now that he's gone, you're going to go in town, you go to Bloomingdale's and find yourself some nice dresses, get yourself some shoes, you know, find somewhere, maybe you get a facial. And, hire a decorator to come in here quick, because damn.
It's a clip from Men in Black 1. My guest, Barry Sonnenfeld, is the director of Men in Black 1 and 2. Barry, who came up with the neuralizer idea?
The neuralizer idea was written into the first script, which was written by a guy named Ed Solomon. And in fact, the neuralizer was one of the reasons that I decided to direct Men in Black, because I grew up as a painfully thin, shy, overprotected Jewish boy, and was incapable of getting a date growing up. And all my life, the thing I would have liked to have had was the ability, after, you know, some girl named Toby in my high school said, you know, I won't go out with you, I won't go see the new Woody Allen movie, and thanks for the chocolate-covered strawberries, but I still think you're, you know, like a geek. I mean, if I had the ability to erase her memory of me ever asking her out, it would be the ultimate joyful thing. I mean, more than anything else, if I could have had a neuralizer growing up, I think I would have become a much less neurotic individual.
too late, huh?
Yeah, I think we're a little late for that.
The neuralizer basically looks like a pocket flashlight. It's like a stick with a light at the end of it. Was it your decision to make it so low-tech looking?
You know, the neuralizer is one of those devices that you think will be easy and cool to work with. And I think we probably spent, in the course of the two movies, maybe $3 or $4 million in shooting time, fixing, repairing, replacing the neuralizer. They're incredibly difficult to get all of this stuff into this skinny little thing. And it doesn't even look like it should be that hard. But in the first Men in Black, we used a flashbulb from an old Kodak Magic Cube camera that was connected to a series of batteries inside the neuralizer. The neuralizer has to, when you press a button, open up and send out a glow, which was red in the first one and cyan in the second one. And the problem with the first Men in Black is every time it flashed, the flashbulb would send out a little puff of smoke. So we were constantly adding more and more fans whenever we were shooting it to try and get the smoke to blow away and be out of frame before the audience saw it. But of course, A, we were blowing like people's hair around. B, the fans were making so much noise, we were thinking we were going to have to loop the dialogue. And it was truly a disaster. And Tommy, I think on the first one, broke maybe 15 or 20 of them. Tommy also was incapable of not on camera making his own sound effects. And so, like, as he would press a button, Tommy would also go, pshew. Or when Tommy would shoot his guns, he would go, kow.
My guest is Barry Sonnenfeld. He directed Men in Black and the new sequel, Men in Black 2. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Barry Sonnenfeld. He directed Men in Black and the new sequel, as well as The Addams Family and Get Shorty. Now, some of the extraterrestrials, particularly I'm thinking of the insect and animal ones, seem to have Yiddish accents when they speak.
You know, I tend to impose my cultural Judaism on my movies. And I find that Yiddish words, just like words that end in K or just like odd numbers as opposed to even numbers, are just funny. So the worm guys, two or three different times in the movie, will say, "Oi." I just find it funny that the worm guys are both aliens, New Yorkers, and possibly have a Jewish background. Frank the Pug, and I don't want to give away the line, but the last line Frank the Pug says in the movie is a Yiddish phrase that I think will be very funny to people in New York and Los Angeles, but I'm thinking that St. Louis may miss out on that particular joke. But I don't know if you remember the Woody Allen movie where, I think it was Sleepers, where you find out that a madman named Albert Shanker blew up an atomic bomb. And the irony is Albert Shanker was the head of the United Federation of Teachers in New York City. And again, in New York and certain, you know, areas around New York, that got a huge laugh. But the weird thing is I also saw the movie in Massachusetts, and it got a little laugh, but it still got a laugh because the name Albert Shanker just sounds like a funny name. And I'm hoping that the same thing happens with Yiddish, that those that know Yiddish will laugh because it's funny, and those who don't will laugh because it just sounds like a weird phrase that maybe an alien might say.
See, I worry that in films it's getting more and more difficult, particularly in big-budget films, to have a joke that might not be gotten by some of the people in the audience, particularly because films have to sell to an international audience now, and some jokes just don't translate to foreign languages, or some, you know, dialects that might be funny don't translate to a foreign language. So is that the kind of thing that the studio wanted you to worry about or maybe even cut out? Because it might not play internationally. It might not even play in parts of America.
I think it won't play in most of America, actually. But in any given film, I need three things that are just for me, which is, you know, which I think is actually a low percentage compared to most directors. I think that most directors end up making films that are like painfully too long, in part because they just don't want to give up the stuff that they worked so hard to achieve, whether it was a crane shot or a shot that took 2 days to do or a scene that they love but isn't helping the movie at all but still love that particular scene. So the fact that I have three little jokes in a movie that are just for myself, I think, is actually a very low percentage. The other thing I feel is I think that most studios don't realize that audiences are smarter than they think they are. And one of the things that I pride myself on is I like to make comedies where I feel the audience is ahead of me and knows where that joke is going and elbows, you know, the husband and says, "Oh, it's going to turn out she's going to be in the next room," or whatever. And in a comedy, I'd rather have a big laugh or no laugh.
Tommy Lee Jones and Will Smith have really nice chemistry together. How did you figure out that they were going to? Like, what kind of tests did you do, screen tests or whatever, to see how they were together on camera?
The way I read scripts is I get a bunch of scripts and I lie in bed with my wife, and we get two copies of every script delivered to us, and she and I read the same script at the same time. And she usually finishes first because she's a better reader. And Sweetie and I read Men in Black, and we closed the scripts, and Sweetie turned to me and said, "Will Smith," and I turned to her and said, "Tommy Lee Jones." And it was really that simple. At that level of actors, you don't do screen tests. You just You don't even audition. You offer them the part and hope they'll take it. And then hope the chemistry works. And what's interesting is I think part of the reason the chemistry works is I have a theory about comedy, which is you never want two funny guys in your comedy. You always want George Burns and Gracie Allen. You always want Abbott and Costello. And we got incredibly lucky with Will and Tommy.
Now, was the role that Will Smith plays written specifically for an African-American actor, or was it just written without any regard to color? Was the assumption, do you think, on the part of the studio that it would be a white actor?
Men in Black was written specifically, really, for two white guys. In fact, the studio, the producers, the executive producer, were all convinced that the Will Smith role, as I like to call it, should be given to Chris O'Donnell. And Chris O'Donnell is an incredibly good actor. He was great in Men Don't Leave and other movies. But my wife told me I should hire Will Smith, so that was really the end of the discussion as far as I was concerned. So the studio said, no, we want Chris O'Donnell. You must hire Chris O'Donnell. Luckily, I went to dinner with Chris, and Chris told me all the reasons he had problems with this script. He didn't think it was funny enough. He didn't think his character was strong enough. He went on and on with legitimate concerns. And I said to Chris, look, Chris, I am not a good enough director to make this script any better. And if I were you, I would not take this role. It's not a good role, and I don't have confidence in myself that I'll make it better. And the next day, Chris passed. The studios then had me meeting every male member of Friends, and they would all schlep out to East Hampton for the day, and I'd drive them around and show them where Spielberg's house was and Lorne Michaels' house was, and then they go back to Los Angeles. And eventually, I just wore down the studio. I got Will Smith to come out to East Hampton to meet with Steven Spielberg, and Will left the meeting, and I think Steven's kids said, you know, Dad, you know, Will Smith is like the coolest guy on earth. And eventually, that's how I was able to get the studio and Steven Spielberg to let me hire Will. I just basically convinced all the other actors that I wasn't a good enough director to work with me.
Barry Sonnenfeld directed Men in Black and the new sequel, Men in Black 2. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Guys dressed in black, remember that, just in case we ever face to face and make contact. The title held by me, M.I.B., means what you think you saw, you did not see. So don't blink, be what was dead is now gone. Black suit with the black Ray-Bans on, walk a shadow, move in silence. Guard.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delta Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Mother Rocket, a collection of stories by Rita Cerisi, author of Pink Slip. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Barry Sonnenfeld, director of the Men in Black films. And now that the Pledge of Allegiance is in the news, our linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the challenging words within the pledge, words that are mispronounced and misunderstood by many kids who recite it.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Barry Sonnenfeld. He directed Men in Black and the new sequel, Men in Black 2, starring Tommy Lee Jones and Will Smith. Sonnenfeld also made The Addams Family, Addams Family Values, Get Shorty, and Big Trouble. When we left off, Sonnenfeld was explaining that the screenplay was written for two white leading actors. Now, I'm thinking demographically for a movie. Although the studio wanted you to cast a white actor in the Will Smith part, it must really get a bigger audience if you have a white and a black actor teamed up, because then, I think it's very possible that African Americans are more likely to turn up to see a movie in which there's an African American star.
I'll tell you the truth. I was just doing what my wife told me to do. I really wasn't thinking commercially.
I just wanted to
make sure Sweetie continued to love and respect me. I will say that I have a friend of mine who's a writer, and he said that he has a list of his favorite studio notes that he's ever received. And he said the third best studio note is a note that's actually a good note, but you don't want to be the studio executive saying it. And the note is, can our lead actor have a really cool black guy as his best friend? And the truth is, you know, it is a good note because it does lead to cultural conflict, very different ways of coming into a scene, of dealing with reality. I mean, Will Smith and I will look at an event on the streets of New York or the way I talk to someone, and Will cannot believe that I can talk to strangers a certain way, in a way that he could never talk to strangers, because he feels if he talked the way I talked, it would become a sort of, it could lead to a fight. And he can't believe what I get away with strangers that he feels he could never get away with.
Did you change the script at all when he signed on?
When Will signed on to do the movie, we didn't change the script in terms of like, adding slang or making his role seem more black or urban, but Will brings that to the table. And a lot of the funniest stuff in Men in Black 1 was written by and ad-libbed by Will Smith. Everything from when Will lands on the top of the bus that is filled with Japanese tourists, and Will says to the Japanese tourists, "It be raining black people in New York." Well, what happened was we had a totally different line. It was like Will Smith lands in the bus with Japanese tourists, and I think we made some obvious joke about cameras, like, you know, because Japanese and cameras, and I hated the line, and we were about to go to lunch, and the next shot after lunch was going to be that shot, and I said, "Will, I hate this line. Go back, write something better." Will came back from lunch and said, "I only came up with one thing, and you're going to think it's too stupid, but here it is. It'd be raining black people in New York," which, of course, I loved, and that's what we used in the movie. Throughout Men in Black and Men in Black 2, Will would continue to ad-lib or pitch, not ad-lib like I didn't know what he was going to say, but he would pitch stuff that just sounded more like it was stuff that he would say. But we didn't change the script and make it more about a black guy or a black guy's point of view.
Barry Sonnenfeld is my guest, and he's the director of Men in Black and Men in Black 2. He also directed Addams Family, Addams Family Values, Get Shorty, and Wild Wild West. The first Men in Black grossed about $600 million. So what pressures are there on you this time around to like make a lot of money and to do a lot of like merchandising tie-ins?
Men in Black 2 was the hardest movie I've ever directed because of the pressures from Men in Black 1, because Men in Black 1 made too much money. In fact, even though I directed Men in Black 1, I was often feeling that the studio and the producers felt, well, they couldn't get the same guy who directed Men in Black 1, so they would get me, but they would help me through the process. It was a very difficult experience in terms of working out the script and in terms of disagreements we had between myself and the producers about the amount of comedy that should or shouldn't be in the movie. And I realized that some of the most successful sequels were sequels of movies that were not ultimately that financially successful in the first place. I think the first Terminator only grossed $40 or $50 million. I think the first Austin Powers even only grossed $40 or $50 million domestically. And now I'm stuck doing a sequel to a movie that grossed worldwide close to $600 million. So the pressure was phenomenal. What made it rewarding was the actual shooting of the movie was much easier than the first one because Tommy and Will were so relaxed because they knew who these characters were. They knew that audience loved those characters, and they just enjoyed playing them. So the shooting was easy. The pressure of doing a sequel when the first one was so successful was overwhelming, not because of merchandising or, you know, making sure we had, like, cool toys or stuff like that, but just the pressure of everyone fearing failure.
So even though you made the first one, you're being challenged all the time. Like, is this going to be good enough? Will it measure up to the first one?
Not only challenge, but doubted.
Right.
It was really difficult. I ended up having so much pressure and anxiety that one night I was convinced I was having a heart attack. 2 weeks into the shoot, and ended up spending the night in a New York hospital, convinced I was having a heart attack. And of course, it was just pure anxiety. But now, I'm done. There's nothing I can do about it. The movie's finished, and it will now have a life of its own.
On nights like that, do you ask yourself, is it worth it?
I'm going to tell you something which is absolutely, I promise you, true. I love my wife. I love my three daughters. And as I was going to the hospital, thinking I was having a heart attack, the only thing going through my mind was, this is a no-lose situation. I either am not having a heart attack and I'm totally healthy, or I die and I don't have to continue to direct this movie. And either option was totally fine with me. And that's the God's honest truth. That is exactly what I was thinking over and over again on the way to Bellevue Hospital, which was, this is a no-lose situation.
You know, it doesn't seem right that a comedy should cause such agony.
You know, comedies are hard to do. And any time that you have a comedy where the crew is laughing in dailies and you know, and every time the actors are just having a great time on the set and it couldn't be more and more fun, those are the ones you have to worry about. Comedy is really hard. And without fail, the scenes that you think aren't working in dailies end up being the funniest scenes. And the scenes where the crew is laughing in dailies and it's playing in one shot, those are the scenes, I promise you, that you end up cutting out of the movie because they somehow don't work within the context of the whole film. It's a very weird gestalt that I still can't figure out.
So, like, when you think that you're really sick and maybe even dying of a heart attack, when the episode is over, you go back to work, do you say to the people in the studio who've been pressuring you, which is part of why you got so sick in the first place, do you say to them, stop, look what you're doing to me, I can't take it anymore, just, like, turn down the heat, cut it out? Would you try to cover it up so that, you know, you look like, hey, I'm not fazed by any of this pressure?
Actually, the studio was great. I was having problems with the producers and not so much the studio, although the studio is very nervous. I'm a big believer in strength through weakness. So I wear my neuroses on my sleeve. And in fact, the next day we had some more script meetings, and I used the almost fatal heart attack, which was an anxiety attack, to my advantage. Everyone was suddenly nice to me and agreed to more of my suggestions than had ever been accepted before. So I don't believe in covering up neurosis or pain at all. I believe in embracing it and using it as a secret weapon.
My guest is Barry Sonnenfeld. He directed Men in Black and the new sequel. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Barry Sonnenfeld is my guest. He directed Men in Black 2 and Men in Black, as well as Get Shorty, Addams Family, and Addams Family Values. What were the science fiction films that you grew up with that you used to watch over and over again on TV?
I was an incredibly nervous kid who was incapable of watching any science fiction. I couldn't watch The Outer Limits or any of those kind of shows. I never went to the movies. I couldn't, to this day, I can't see scary movies. I've never seen The Exorcist or The Shining. A good friend of mine, Larry Kasdan, who's a film director, is just finished directing a Stephen King novel, and I already told Larry, don't invite me to the premiere. Don't ask me to look at your movie in progress. I'm telling you right now, I will never, ever see your movie. And in a weird way, I think a little bit of the success of the Men in Black series is that I really have no knowledge of science fiction or science fiction movies. And, you know, I feel that our movies are trying much harder to be a documentary than a science fiction movie.
What is it that you find so difficult about scary movies or science fiction movies?
I'm really afraid. I'm just afraid. I mean, late at night, you know, we live out in the country on the in the end of Long Island, and, you know, in the winter, you know, the heating system will come on or something, or the wind will blow a certain way, and I'll wake up, and I'll wake up my wife and make her go get on a bathrobe, go downstairs and check the house while I put the blankets over my head thinking that if I can't see them, they can't see me. I can't sleep with a closet door open, and I just live in constant fear of the unknown, and I know everyone's out to get me. And I'm not thinking of like robbers or bandits. I'm really thinking about the big unknown.
Is your wife a sport about this?
My wife has been a sport for almost 20 years. She's amazingly willing to put up with a tremendous amount of neuroses and fear.
Now, what about your parents when you were growing up? How did they deal with their son being so scared all the time?
It is my parents that made me who I am. You know, I think my mom worked very hard in to make me afraid of everything so that I would stay at home as long as possible. The ultimate story is that we may have discussed this 10 years ago, but on April 22nd, 1970, at 2 in the morning during a Earth Day concert, while Jimi Hendrix was warming up at Madison Square Garden, in front of 19,600 people, over the PA system came the following announcement: Barry Sonnenfeld, call your mother. And I think to this day, that is why I am living in constant fear.
What did she want, and how did she manage to get her message on the PA system?
She wanted me to call her to convince her that I hadn't already been killed, because I said I would be home at 2 in the morning and it was like now 2:20. And I have no idea how she convinced or what she told the PA system or how many people she had to pretend were killed in order to get me to call. But they did page me and I did call. And being a fearful Jewish only child, as soon as I heard the announcement, I assumed that someone close to me had been, you know, had died. I assume my dad had died of a massive heart attack. He's still fine. Mom has moved on. But that's you know, I think that her fear and my fear are all locked together in an incredibly disgusting Freudian way.
Barry Sonnenfeld is my guest. He directed Men in Black 2 and Men in Black, as well as Get Shorty, Addams Family, and Addams Family Values. Now, you actually got started in movies making pornography. You were directing it?
No, I was when I graduated from NYU film school, a friend and I bought a 16-millimeter camera, the theory being if we owned a camera, we could call ourselves cameramen. And he knew a guy who was a porno director and producer and got us onto the job, and we were able to rent our camera for 9 days and get paid a little money in addition, which for us meant that those 9 days of rental for our camera paid for about a quarter of the entire cost of the camera in one fell swoop. So it was really a horrible job, and I don't recommend it.
So you wanted to move on to more mainstream movies, I imagine, after this?
The fact that I got to pay for a quarter of my camera was very cool. But what really ended up changing my professional life was I had accidentally been invited to a party one night by a woman named Hillary Ney, who grew up in Darien, Connecticut. And at this party were only WASPy guys and girls in their early 20s, and all of their parents, for some reason, owned coal mines in Pennsylvania. And there was only one other Jew across the room, and that was Joel Cohen. And somehow we sniffed each other out, and we started to talk about movies that had recently come out. And we were talking about Wim Wenders, An American Friend, and Joel told me that he had just written this script with his brother Ethan called Blood Simple. And they were looking for a guy to shoot a trailer as if it were a finished film, and they were going to use that trailer to raise money to eventually go and shoot what became Blood Simple. Because I owned a camera, Joel that night hired me. We became best friends. I helped them raise the money, which took a year. We raised $750,000. We then went off to Austin, Texas to shoot Blood Simple with me as a cinematographer. And the first day on Blood Simple was the first day that Joel, Ethan, or I had ever been on a film set.
You've painted a picture of your mother being very overly protective and of yourself growing up as really neurotic and probably really unsure of any powers that you might have. And now you are really pretty powerful in Hollywood, being able to make, you know, blockbusters with big budgets and having to command this huge army of people, you know, special effects and animators and actors and so on. Does it, like, not fit your image of yourself to be a person who actually has a fair amount of power?
Yeah, you know, I can't believe what happened to me, considering where I came from and how insecure and unself-confident I was growing up. And really what changed all of that for me, what has given me a sense of confidence and self-respect and a sense of empowerment even, is when Sweetie, who became my wife, fell in love with me. And the fact that I'm married to this capable, beautiful, smart, self-confident woman who decided that she would marry me made me think, well, maybe there's more to me than I thought, because what's this special person doing with me? So I believe that all the self-confidence that I now have has come from that special relationship.
Well, Barry Sonnenfeld, thank you so much for talking with us. Congratulations on the new Men in Black, and thank you.
Thank you for inviting me back on.
Barry Sonnenfeld directed Men in Black and the new sequel, Men in Black 2. Coming up, two words in the Pledge of Allegiance have made headlines. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the other words in the pledge. This is Fresh Air. The recent court decision declaring the Pledge of Allegiance unconstitutional has set off a national debate. A three-judge panel of the Ninth Circuit ruled last month that the phrase "under God" violated the separation of church and state. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has been thinking about what the pledge actually means.
Here's the odd thing about the pledge, that people can take its wording so seriously at the same time they find it charming when people get it wrong. It's classic Art Linkletter stuff. I led a pigeon to the flag and to the republic for witches' dance, one naked individual. And nobody seems to mind that even older students are unclear on the meanings of words like allegiance and republic. In fact, it's often said that the very obscurity of the pledge is what makes the phrase "under God" constitutionally unobjectionable. Back in 1984, Justice William Brennan described the phrase as a form of ceremonial deism, which has lost through rote repetition any significant religious content. You heard that argument a lot in criticisms of the Ninth Circuit decision. Newsday described the pledge as a harmless civic recitation. And in the Washington Post, Mark Fisher wrote that God's name is just a frill, a space filler in the unthinking torrent of daily conversation. To hear some people tell it, you might conclude that there's not much difference between saying "one nation under God" and "one nation by God." But if the pledge is merely a harmless civic recitation, why the torrent of invective over the Ninth Circuit's decision, to the point where some op-ed trombones were comparing it with a straight face to the September 11th attacks? As columnist Cal Thomas wrote, "The court inflicted on this nation what many will conclude is a greater injury than that caused by the terrorists." And even if most people would find that comparison offensive, there's no question that the indignation over the decision was very broad and very deep. Of course, the pledge isn't the only obscurely worded patriotic text that can evoke strong feelings. The Star-Spangled Banner is famously unparsable. How many people could tell you with confidence what ramparts are or why anyone was watching them? And I'm sure I wasn't the only school child who wondered why we were singing a song to "My Country, 'Tis of Thee" when everybody knew we lived in America. But the pledge is the only one of those texts that was actually written for recitation by schoolchildren. It was composed in 1892 by Francis Bellamy, a socialist clergyman, as the centerpiece of an elaborate Columbus Day ceremony sponsored by the National Education Association, which was designed to promote the use of the American flag in the public schools. Bellamy made no concessions to the linguistic limitations of his young audience. Those obscure words, "I pledge allegiance," were intended as an allusion to the oath of allegiance to the Union that many Southerners were required to sign before their political rights were restored after the Civil War. But the words wouldn't have had much meaning to schoolchildren in the 1890s, 40 years after the war had ended. Nor would children have made much sense of Bellamy's original wording of the end of the pledge, "with liberty, fraternity, and equality for all," a phrase that the sponsors rejected as too radical and too French. Granted, that was an age that delighted in high-blown patriotic language. Late 19th century schoolchildren were expected to memorize and declaim patriotic speeches like Patrick Henry's "Give Me Liberty" and Daniel Webster's "Against Hayne." But the pledge persevered even after those exercises were dropped from the curriculum. And in fact, its syntax grew more convoluted as time went by. Bellamy had originally written, "I pledge allegiance to my flag." But in 1924, that was changed over his objection to the much clumsier "The Flag of the United States of America," this at the urging of the Daughters of the American Revolution, who were fearful that immigrants might take the reference to "my flag" as ambiguous. The pledge became even more opaque when the "under God" phrase was added in 1954 to emphasize the difference between us and the godless communists. Whether or not you agree with the sentiment of that addendum, it's hard to defend its syntax. "One nation, under God, indivisible." It isn't just that the phrase disconnects the modifier "indivisible" from the word "nation." It's also not clear exactly what "under God" is supposed to mean. The phrase was taken from the Gettysburg Address, but Lincoln used it as an adverb. "This nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom." Whereas in the pledge, "under God" was somehow changed to an adjective, which leaves its meaning up for grabs. Does it mean we believe in God, or that we're subject to God, or that we have his personal attention? But then, that vagueness is probably what commends the phrase in the first place. School teachers sometimes try to explain the pledge to their charges in words that they can understand. I promise to be true to the symbol of my country, the United States, a single country where people believe in a supreme being and which can't be split apart. But most people would resist any effort to change the official wording to something more comprehensible. We like the pledge as it is, in all its turgid opacity. As Eric Hobsbawm once observed, patriotic rituals aren't supposed to be transparent. They're there to provide the emotional signs of membership in a club, not its bylaws. All that talk about harmless civic recitations gets the pledge wrong, because there is a point to having children gather in collective surrender to sentences they don't really comprehend. That's where patriotism takes its most irreducible form. When it comes to the crunch, it's a question of da-da-da flag, da-da-da America, da-da-da God, da-da-da liberty, da-da-da for all.
Jeff Nunberg is a researcher at Stanford's Center for the Study of Language and Information and the author of the book, The Way We Talk Now. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Jessica Chu, and Lauren Krenzel. I'm Terry Gross. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the state of Vermont, connecting summer travelers with the mountains, lakes, and historic villages of rural Vermont. Online travel planning at VermontVacation.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with two doctors, one Israeli, the other Palestinian, who work at the Hadassah Hospital in Jerusalem, treating Palestinians and Israelis, including casualties of suicide bombings and the Israeli military actions. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.